And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
For 26 years, Hazel the chimpanzee has lived in a sanctuary in Austria, where he has become accustomed to getting his favorite pastries, watching television, greeting his friends with hugs and kisses. But with the sanctuary facing a serious lack of funding, Hazel now becomes a piece of property that can be sold. Until now, animals like the great apes have been treated as things with no more rights than a chair. But an international effort is attempting to have Hazel and other great apes given protections similar to our own. Today, we explore the new persons of interest and bring you the second weekly Earth Summit when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One wonders if a time is coming when the great apes will have guarantees, like us, of life, liberty, and happiness, or is this just the folly of some extreme animal rights advocates? With an increasing understanding that great apes, the chimps, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans, share a high degree of self-awareness, feel empathy and sorrow, grieve for lost family, remember old friends for years on end, solve complex problems, communicate with one another and with humans using a variety of communication tools. A serious debate is emerging as to what rights these animals, which share over 95% of the same genetic code as we humans, what rights should they have? And some would say, should they have any rights at all? It's a debate that goes back hundreds of years and even finds some of its genesis in the slave trade's past. But a legal battle over the future of a 26-year-old chimpanzee is bringing this question into the European courts. And today, we talk with the president of the Great Ape Project, who is directly involved establishing rights for great apes as persons, with more standing than has ever been afforded non-human beings before. This is a very important issue for anyone who thinks about and cares about the well-being and the survival of the other great animals besides humans on this earth. We'll be going in-depth on this topic in segment 2. But first, we bring you our second weekly Earth Summit, bringing you a dynamic overview of thought and concern from the world's leading nature and environmental voices. So now, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues and observations of our world and your future. So now, we're pleased to open this week's summit with a challenge for all of us from Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who just returned from a month traveling around the country, bringing a call to action to the nation's faith communities.
I have been to the mountain, and it was not there. This is not poetry, but the reality I confronted a week ago in eastern Kentucky. The Appalachian Mountains are being laid to waste in an operation called mountaintop removal. More accurately, it is the mountaintop, middle, bottom, and valley that is destroyed in the process of extracting the 3-foot seam of coal that fuel America's energy needs. Only a poet could do justice to the phenomenon of the missing mountain. It is a hard thing to get my mind around, much less my soul. I lack the skill to convey my horror. Thousands of years ago, a Hebrew poet penned the 148th Psalm, and I quote, "Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures in all ocean depths, lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do his bidding, you mountains and hills," end quote. How many of those things which glorify our Creator and give beauty to our world will be laid to waste in an effort to fulfill our wants? The answer is in our hands every time we turn on a clothes dryer, television, or lamp. Moses received the Ten Commandments on a mountain, and Jesus preached his greatest sermon on one. He said that if we had the faith, we could move mountains. Now I pray that the same power can preserve the mountains. Lastly, seeing mountains removed and valley streams buried brings into vivid reality the childish notion that we can use non-renewable resources and then pay a fee to offset the result. Once a mountain is destroyed, it is gone, and no carbon indulgence paid can offset or mitigate the sin of its removal.
Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. We now hear a bit of a warning from the president of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope, who offers some different observations on the nature industry.
If you've been feeling sorry for former House Resources Chair Richard Pombo, upset last November by wind power expert Jerry McNerney, stop. Corrupted congressmen always find a safe landing pad. Pombo was signed up with PacWest Communications, a lobbying firm that specializes in making corrupt legislative deals look like good public policy. PacWest, for example, last year won the $3 million contract with the state of Alaska to coordinate a campaign to make it look like the American people wanted to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to the oil industry. PacWest also wrote Pombo's old bill to gut the Endangered Species Act, then set up a phony front group, the Save Our Species Coalition, to make the bill look respectable, lobbied for it, and topped it off with major contributions to Pombo's re-election campaign. Even so, PacWest may not have hired Pombo just for the past services he rendered them while in Congress. The company's president, Paul Phillips, has a soft spot for the kind of ethical challenges Pombo consistently ran into. In 1990, while he was in the Oregon legislature, Phillips was fined $17,000 for doing pretty much what Pombo did, using his public office to feather his private nest. However scummy PacWest is, it does seem the right kind of employer for Pombo. But there are alarming signs that this job may only be temporary. Pombo's figured out that it is easier to be a corrupted member of Congress, less work, and perhaps more lucrative than to cover up for them. Asked whether he expected to stay with a lobbying business, Pombo recently told the Stockton Record he wasn't so sure. To be honest, I haven't made 100% sure I'm not going to run. I'm just going to wait it out and figure this when things settle down. I want to see if this, meaning taking advantage of the public, is something I want to do again. Of course, if Pombo does run for Congress again, and if the voters are foolish enough to give him the keys to their treasury, PacWest and its clients, the oil, mining, and timber companies, will be the first in the line at his office doors. When are the American people going to realize that the old line, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it is a duck, applies to political ethics? If a campaign contribution or lobbying strategy looks like, acts like, and walks like a bribe, quack.
I want to extend a personal greeting to all Sierra Club members who are joining us now each week for the weekly Earth Summit. Thank you, Carl Pope. Dave Foreman has served in years past on the board of the Sierra Club. As always, he cuts his own path to tomorrow and invites those brave enough to follow.
In my 35 years as a conservationist, I have never beheld such a bleak and depressing situation as I see today. The evidence for my despair falls into three categories: the state of nature, the power of anti-conservationists, and appeasement and weakness within the conservation and environmental movements. I fear that on some level, we must recognize that this state of affairs may be inevitable and impossible to turn around. That is the coward's way out, though. The bleakness we face is all the more reason to stand tall for our values and to not flinch in the good fight. In December of 1776, the American Revolution was in its darkest hour. In response, Tom Paine wrote his first crisis paper, These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. General Washington had the paper read to his miserable, disheartened troops in their frozen winter camps. There was no surrender. Years of hard battle lay ahead, but victory was gained. We need Tom Paine conservationists in our dark hour. Let us not apologize for loving wild nature, for caring about other species, for speaking the truth. Reach out to others. Make deals when they are good deals. But let us not be frightened and browbeaten into appeasement. Let us instead offer a bold, hopeful vision for how wilderness and civilization can live together.
I encourage everyone to follow Dave through his work with the Rewilding Institute. Thanks, Dave. A new generation of environmental activists is speaking out to youth across the nation. We're pleased to introduce one of our regular participants to the weekly Earth Summit, Emma Sleeth, who offers a unique perspective to people of all ages. Emma?
In order to save the planet, my generation needs three things: hearts, minds, and strength. A hardened heart is like a haircut. Last year, my friend cut off a foot of her hair for locks of love. Every time I saw her for a month after, I was continually surprised to see gentle waves of brown curling about her ears, no longer able to reach into her customary ponytail. But after a while, I got used to it. Now I have a hard time picturing Hannah with long hair. The same thing can happen with the environment. Every time we hear about the declining state of the ecosystem, we can immediately determine to recycle everything, pick up trash by the side of the road, and carpool more. But then we can lose our enthusiasm. Soon pollution again seems normal. Greenhouse gases and curbside litter unavoidable. Loss of zeal really means loss of heart. In order to make a difference, we must really care about the people that a polluted environment is affecting. To protect the environment effectively, we must also have minds. We must educate ourselves about the state of the ecosystem and where it will be heading in the very near future if we do nothing to intervene. Remember when you were younger and you somehow didn't hear your mom when she called you inside for dinner? Don't worry. The God of the universe hasn't borrowed your mother's floral apron and swatting spoon. But I believe we will be held accountable for what we do or don't do for the environment. With massive climate changes and a plethora of information available to us, saying we didn't know is going to sound pretty lame. The third quality we need is strength. I'm not talking about physical do 100 push-ups at one go kind of strength. No, what I'm talking about is a determination to do what's right, no matter how fruitless or tiring it may seem. Every time I clean my room, I promise myself that I won't let it get messy again. And then the second law of thermodynamics kicks in. Hey, it's the thought that counts, right? Wrong. The Earth does not register good intentions. Protecting the ecosystem cannot become another New Year's resolution, an exercise plan, or a work ethic that fizzles out after 3 weeks. My generation needs to use their God-given hearts, minds, and strength if we are going to change the world.
In the months ahead, we'll be announcing Emma's book on environmental action. We look forward to hearing from you regularly. Thanks, Emma. Our future involves the decisions right before us, as we hope we make the right decisions locally and regionally, which is where most of the effects of climate change will actually be felt. To expand on this perspective, we are given wise counsel by the eminent Dr. Charles Kennel, who provides advice to the world's leading scientific alliances. Dr. Kennel.
The 2007 IPCC report projects a global warming of 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade over the next 2 decades, twice what we experienced at the end of the 20th century. But even if we could hold greenhouse gas and aerosol concentrations back at their year 2000 level, which we have not done and cannot do, we're going to get 0.1 degree per decade for a century or more. And this means that no matter what we do about fossil fuel use, we'll have to adapt to the climate change that's already in store for us. And in particular, California and the American West are going to have to cope with the long-term drying trend. People don't live on the globe. They live in regions and communities. They have their own environments, their ecologies, economics, politics, and social attitudes. While the IPCC can forecast the global drivers of regional climate change, they can't be expected to understand the needs of the citizens living in every region of the world. California has 16 distinct climatic regions, as anyone who drives inland from the ocean can easily appreciate. And Californians care about their 16 regions. We need to do our own assessments. We're already leading the way. The California Energy Commission's Our Changing Climate Assessment set the context for the agreements between California and the UK and amongst the five western states, all to cooperate on climate change. This shows how regional assessments, how influential they can be. Assessments are going to have to become a way of life for California. State agencies will use them in important water management and natural hazard decisions. How high and when should we rebuild the levees in the Sacramento Delta? Farmers and the banking institutions that finance agriculture need them. The Department of Forestry will use their wildfire forecasts. Energy companies will use their forecasts of electricity usage and hydropower generation in making their investment decisions. Environmental managers in our cities, towns, and parks will use them. The protection of California's ecosystems and wildlife will depend on them. Fisheries managements will use them. In 10 years' time, climate science may be able to reduce the lead time of its forecast to 10 years. This would give highly actionable information to investors and government, and we should adopt this as a goal for California now.
Regional thinking is where you live. Perhaps the term bioregional perspective may stage a comeback. Thank you, Dr. Cannell. We are all in this together. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy knows this as well as anyone. Dr. Lovejoy, thanks for your thoughts this week.
Now, we recently had the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about the impacts of climate change on the natural world. And I think it's quite clear now that the natural world is the most sensitive of all the things we care about that can be affected by climate change. We're seeing changes in nature all over the world, changes in flowering time, changes in nesting time, species changing where they live, changing in altitude, changing in latitude. We're seeing mismatches where one species in a relationship depends on day length, the other depends on temperature, and suddenly they're no longer in sync. And we're seeing thresholds passed in ecosystems so that, for example, in the Northwest and British Columbia and southern Alaska, the coniferous forests are suddenly being attacked in a major way by a native pest, the pine bark beetle. But with warmer summer nights and essentially longer summers, suddenly the balance is tipped in their favor. So there are places where 70% of the trees are dead. So basically, if we allow climate change to go on business as usual and get worse, we're going to see the very biological underpinnings of human society be shaken in an unprecedented way. So nature is telling us it's time to get the climate change and greenhouse gas problem under control.
In order to truly build a global response, it will take the united efforts of professionals from around the globe. Building that effort through action, we now invite Dr. Robin Moore to invite everyone around the world interested in the future of amphibians to begin building that united effort. Dr. Moore?
In September 2005, over 60 of the world's leading experts in amphibian conservation and research convened in Washington, D.C. for an amphibian summit. This summit was a response to mounting evidence over the preceding decades that amphibians have been going extinct and declining worldwide. This realization prompted the global community to come together to formulate a response. The summit tackled a number of themes from disease, climate change, captive breeding and reintroduction to develop a global strategy in the form of the Amphibian Conservation Action Plan. This action plan will be published within the next couple of months. Associated with the action plan was a budget of $400 million. This is the amount it was estimated it would cost to halt the crisis. Prior to the summit, a number of disparate bodies had been tackling amphibian conservation at the global scale. The Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force had made amazing advances in our knowledge of amphibian declines worldwide. The Global Amphibian Assessment had provided an update on the status of amphibians and continues to provide an update on the status. Following the summit, it was realized that a unified global entity was required to tackle the problem at the scale necessary. This led to the formation of the Amphibian Specialist Group, into which the Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force folded, and the Global Amphibian Assessment will also fold. If you'd like more information about the Amphibian Specialist Group, including the bi-monthly newsletter Froglog, which details the activities of the Amphibian Specialist Group and amphibian researchers working in the field, please visit the website www.amphibians.org.
We must unite our observations of the changes taking place. That means we all have to pay attention to the real world around us. Dr. Mark Beckhoff sends us onward with some of his observations on how paying attention to the wild creatures applies to our broader lives. Dr. Beckhoff.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that I try to do is people ask me, well, what is knowing about animal behavior do for you in terms of encountering a wild animal? I'll say, well, when you see a mountain lion, you're supposed to stand upright and scream and make yourself really big. If you have a bike, wave the bike. If you have a stick, wave the stick. Of course, what I've done in the past when I've had the lion encounters is I run, because that's what you instinctively do. But people are also interested in practical issues, like what happens when a real aggressive dog comes up to you. Well, what I generally do is I turn and walk away very slowly. Sometimes I'll face the dog, but generally I'll turn around and I'll walk away slowly. I won't make any sudden move. I surely won't run away fast, although I want to, because that's like a pursuit invitation signal, we call it. That's an invitation for the animal to chase you. Some people say that if you roll over and you're really scared and you pee in your pants, that might work, and it might. I've never done that. But my tendency with a real aggressive dog is to just get away slowly, simply because they can be pretty unpredictable. And you just, you know, you don't know about the history of the dog. You don't know the dog's psychological makeup. And so by lying down, you may, you know, be exposing a vulnerable part of your body. So I think that, you know, those are sort of lessons from animal behavior. When I encounter coyotes around my house, once again, I walk away slowly. I may say, you know, I may talk to them in a really, really gentle, mellow voice. But, you know, sometimes with a mountain lion, you have to confront them. With this bear on my porch, I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I've heard reports from other people about, you know, bears and even coyotes, that they're so habituated, this bear didn't flinch. He finally ran off my porch when I went to the door, and I was standing at the screen door, and I was starting to close the glass sliding porch door, and I noticed he was backing up a bit, so I opened the door a bit, because I knew I could actually shut it before he could get in it, and I just kind of looked at him, and very gently I said, "What are you doing here? You know, please leave my porch." And then when I stepped towards him, and I was probably only about 3 feet from him, but still protected partly by the door, he ran off the porch. So there's a problem, I think you can see, that with habituated animals, you just don't know what to do. The other problem, of course, is a lot of these animals have been shed, and then they people stop feeding them, and that's the worst of the worst situation. When you read about kids getting attacked by wildlife or even adults, it's because the wildlife have been fed, and then they stop feeding them, and they're accustomed to food.
I want to thank this great alliance of advocates that will be meeting and sharing their thoughts each week on the weekly Earth Summit here on the Wildside News. Now do what you can, which means to spread the word about the most important 15 minutes on Earth until we convene again next week. This is your host, Sydney Wildsmith. See you then. Tune in each week for the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Coming up, should Hazel, the 26-year-old chimpanzee, be offered the same rights as any other person? The legal debate is taking place as we speak. this precedent-setting court battle is gaining traction in Europe, and there's plenty of interest here as well. Stay tuned as we go in-depth with the president of the Great Ape Project when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Are animals things, or are they more than simply a thing? If they are things, then if you own it, you can do what you want with it. You could, if you like, hook it up to machines and see how much pain it can endure before dying. You could inject it with all sorts of morbid viruses and bacteria and drugs to see what might happen. You could, if you like, cut out sections of its brain to study the effects of experimental brain surgery. But some are saying great apes are conscious. They're sentient. They feel. They're intelligent. They're aware. They love. They grieve the loss of other beings, and therefore deserve to be treated as such. And that means giving them protections. And that means they are becoming more like humans in the eyes of the law. Stay tuned. To what degree are great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans similar to humans? They share 95% of our DNA. They act like us. They entertain us. Anyone who works with them knows that they are much more than just an animal. As a matter of fact, they are amazingly human in many ways. And now a 26-year-old chimpanzee faces an uncertain future. And it's raising some very serious questions about whether Heasel, that's his name, can be treated with no concern for what his 26 years of life and friendships and happiness represent. Does Heasel have rights? If so, what are they? And how will the court define them? We go in depth with Heasel, following a brief review of this week's Nature News. So now, the news. As global warming heats things up, the world's oceans are already feeling the heat, and it's directly responsible for a sudden increase in what scientists call white syndrome, in which mature coral reefs are effectively turned lifeless with even a minor increase in ocean temperatures. The stories have been coming in for years. Now the science is backing up the findings. To date, 25% of the world's corals have already been lost. And it's expected that another 30% will be gone in the next 30 years. Corals, which serve an important component of the complex life cycles of thousands of sea creatures, are disappearing at an alarming rate. There is no effective fix imagined yet, as the warming trends already have a momentum that will take years to change, even with the extraordinary efforts by the global community. Puget Sound has, for a long time, been one of the best spots to watch killer whales do what whales do, put on fantastic displays of leaps and twists and what many perceive as wondrous family-bonding displays. But suddenly, killer whales in Puget Sound are dying and disappearing, despite protections offered by being designated a marine sanctuary. But a recent finding by a whale-loving biologist who has listened with sensitive underwater microphones to the calls, clicks, and squeals of the local killer whale community proves that powerful underwater sonar used by U.S. naval vessels in the bay cause sudden disorientation, reflexes to flee and surface, potentials for sudden beachings, and ultimately explain the problem. A recent encounter of a naval vessel in the sanctuary was recorded, and with quick action, the captain of the naval vessel was alerted and the sonar discontinued. Please, let this be noted generally throughout the militaries of the world. Stop torturing the great other beings on the planet for no real reason at all. With much of the world looking for alternatives to oil, biofuel is the alternative of choice to increase energy security, reduce greenhouse gases, and spur new markets for farmers. The oil lords of the Middle East, beginning with OPEC's Fuad Siala, are taking lessons from the pharmaceutical companies that keep reminding us that unless they can keep drug prices high, they may have to cut back on research, which could result in less effective drugs, longer waits to bring new drugs to market, and so we should be happy to pay that high price. The OPEC captains of carbon emissions say that because people are looking at alternatives, they may have to invest less than oil production, which could ultimately threaten the future supplies and could even cause an unexpected oil shortage in the years ahead, which, if we just stopped creating such insecurity for them and kept buying their oil, they could keep investing in making oil for us all. Enough said. And finally, many of the world's leading scientific institutions announced the launch of the Encyclopedia of Life, a first-of-its-kind global effort to document all 1.8 million named species of animals, plants, and other forms of life, and make it all accessible through the Internet. Cooperating at the Field Museum, Harvard University, the Marine Biological Laboratory of Woods Hole, the Smithsonian Institution, and the Biodiversity Heritage Library, all uniting their efforts with a global array of partners and patrons, this multi-million-dollar effort is expected to take 10 years to complete. This complete listing will be drawn from the more than 250 years of scientific classification, note-taking, and notations, and pull them all into a fully illustrated, globally accessible website. Thank you, John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, for creating this important catalog of life. And that's the news. And now, to our main story. The future of the wild creatures is gaining a lot of prominence all of a sudden on the planet. People are waking up to the fact that it does matter, in particular as we look at some of the issues of global warming and the issues of the future of polar bears, for example, and the concern about whether or not they'll survive, but then as well the larger issues of mass extinction are being discussed. And so the future of animals is very significant. And certainly there's possibly no more compelling stories and questions than circulate around the issue of the future of some of the most significant creatures, particularly those that are most closely related to us, and that, of course, becomes the great apes. We hear a lot coming from Jane Goodall and others who are working in research and preserving these species and the demise that's happening to their habitats and as well their themselves and their communities as they're being treated as bushmeat by indigenous peoples and others. So their future is really challenged. There's many aspects to this issue of the primates and animal rights, and there's many ways in which people that try to approach this. And right now we're going to take a terrific path into this topic of animal rights with someone who's central to literally redefining some of the rights from a legalistic perspective. And this is Michelle Stumpy, who is the president of the Great Ape Project USA and as well the president of the Great Ape Project International. She's joining us now from Atlanta. Michelle, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Michelle, first of all, I've come across the Great Ape Project, otherwise known as GAP, because of a recent story about a 26-year-old chimpanzee, Heasel, who yes. is facing some very difficult times ahead, some real questions, and it's raising some legal issues. And because much of the work of the Great Ape Project has to do with legalities, tell our audience why it is that you're looking at this question of Heasel right now, particularly from its legal basis.
Well, it's a very important issue to us because the Great Ape Project is founded upon really extending the protections that are currently available to the great apes. Currently, under our legal system, unfortunately, these creatures are treated as property, so pretty much anything can be done to them. And Hazel is a great example. He has been in a sanctuary for 26 years and is now possibly going to be sent to a research facility. And so the issue that is placed is what can be done to protect Hazel from, first of all, being sent to the research facility, and second of all, with respect to the funds that are being donated to his care, how can it be ensured that those funds will be used in his best interest rather than just being sent to the research facility for his basic living expenses. The way our current legal system works, he is not entitled to have a guardian or have his best interest considered. And so this lawsuit that has been filed is really an effort to work within the legal structure as it is to grant him the bare basic rights that are necessary to have a guardian appointed so that his best interest will be taken into consideration with respect to his future and the funds that are being donated for his benefit.
What this kind of boils down to is that what you're trying to do is to find a legal basis for giving him, in essence, the rights that a person may have. And it's creating a terrific amount of flap out there because a lot of people are suggesting that what you're trying to do is to suggest that the great apes and humans are the same. Why don't you help us understand what your real position is?
Okay. And we do get that quite a bit. I think the problem is that a lot of people... And it's understandable, unless you have been trained as a lawyer, some of the legal terminology tends to be misconstrued or misunderstood. We are not saying that great apes are the same as humans. We're not seeking that they have the right to vote or go out and drive a car. We're simply looking at, from a realistic and practical perspective, that they be granted the rights that are necessary to give them the freedom from torture, the right to life, the freedom from arbitrary deprivation of liberty, from being taken from their homeland, as Hazel was. And so this idea of personhood or being given the rights as a legal person is often misunderstood. One of the things I think I would like to just point out and remind the listeners is that, for example, in our structure, in our legal structure, a corporation is considered a legal person. Now, that doesn't mean a corporation is a human. It's just that in order for an entity to have the rights, to have their best interest is considered, to have the rights to sue, they have to be considered legally defined as a person. And so that's all we're seeking for the great apes, is that they be given that legal definition that would entitle creatures such as Hazel to the appointment of a guardian to have his best interest considered and protected from the torture that he will imminently face in a research facility.
There's some terrifically interesting historical roots, from at least as I've thought about this issue. And really what the fundamental issue has to do with the fact that we have humans who are given these rights, and then almost everything else is other than human, and therefore does not have the same rights. What this means is that, in essence, therefore, a great ape becomes a thing, as opposed to something greater than just a thing, and therefore it can be bought and sold and treated as a thing, an object.
Exactly.
It can be, it's almost, if there isn't some higher level of status given to a creature like a great ape, it's pretty much you can do whatever you want with that creature, and that is part of the story, because what happens is these animals are treated that way, for example, in research facilities, and it becomes quite a debatable issue. Help us understand that difference between, that's sort of a middle ground, at least that's how I interpret it, between being human and being an object.
And that really, I think, taps into the moral and ethical background of the Great Ape Project and where we're coming from, because I think most people would agree that great apes are not, shouldn't be considered things like a chair or something that I could just throw out a window and not have any consequences to having done so. You shouldn't be able to just torture them and poke them and prod them and cut them and take away food and see how they react under certain deprivation type of circumstances. A lot of people tend to ask, why great apes? And a lot of the animal rights groups, for example, wonder, you know, why do we focus on great apes in our quest for legal rights to be extended to them? And there is an abundance of scientific research that has observed and documents what they call the sentience of these animals. These are extraordinary animals. They share emotions such as fear, anxiety, and happiness. They kiss to make up, they laugh, they cry, they have the ability to create and use tools to hunt. I think one of the amazing things is they have the ability to learn language, and not only learn our language, sign language, but they then on their own will teach it to their young and add new words, new vocabulary to that language. So there's certainly a forethought that they experience. They plan for their future. They mourn for the loss of loved ones. They have a great degree of emotions and a level of intelligence that really, I think, if we're going to look at it in any kind of moral perspective, we have to say, doesn't that deserve some sort of protection greater than that of a chair or just a mere piece of property that anybody can do with what they please without any significant ramifications?
You know, it's interesting because the concept of slavery was based on a notion that, talking about the United States, mm-hmm. that blacks really were less than human and therefore could be treated as property, and that also rights shouldn't be extended to them because they weren't capable of really exercising the full panoply of great advantage of democracy and liberty and things of that nature. And so to some extent, I like to think of this as a question of whether or not we have the right to enslave creatures, that becomes something that people can more easily kind of resonate with, because that is in truth what we do. We treat these animals as our personal slaves.
And it's interesting that you bring up that point, because there have been many parallelisms drawn to the treatment of great apes, to the treatment of the African slaves historically. And interestingly, there are documented cases of humans being kept in zoos as back in the years and in our history. So it is an interesting question. And a number of people will question what we are seeking and think, okay, well, if you're not in favor of the capture or the captivity of these creatures, what do you propose we do? We can't just, we're going to have to open up all the zoos and let all the great apes roam free. Certainly, unfortunately, for the great apes, that's just not practical, and it's not realistic. They can't survive out in the wild because we have taken them from their natural homelands. We can't put them back in their natural homelands where they belong because they simply can't survive there. So it's important that sanctuaries continue to develop, and that, really what we're looking at is taking a different perspective and what is in the best interest of these creatures, not treating them as our slaves or as our property for our own entertainment, as we see in the entertainment industry, where, unfortunately, great apes are tortured, particularly chimpanzees are tortured, or they use very frightening techniques to get the chimpanzees to do what they do on television. And it's just morally not right.
Well, for example, I don't think there's very many humans out there that would think it would be right to take, let's say, a horse or, for example, a pony or some other animal like that, and literally hook them up to a machine and then basically force them to work until they dropped it dead. anybody who witnessed that or even thought about that, they would say there's something wrong with that. That's not right. That's, we can't just treat animals that way. But the corollary that, that disturbs me, and I think it also is what tends to drive some of your effort, is that to a large extent, that's exactly what is happening to these great apes in research facilities. And I'm not going after research facilities. That's not my effort here. I'm not trying to close them all down. But I am saying that we definitely have to look at these questions and say, if we wouldn't do this to a horse or a pony, to hook it up to a machine that forced them to work until they dropped dead from exhaustion, that would be torture, that would be cruel and unusual punishment, and it wouldn't be right to do that to any animal. Nevertheless, these animals, like the great apes who are in some of the research facilities, things happen to them that I'm sure you could expand on, that literally forces them to be in a perpetual state of pain, agony, in essence, torture. And yet somehow we see that differently. Am I right about that?
You are. You're exactly right about that. And I think that there's a couple of different aspects of that issue. One of the aspects is that because we're selfish and there is a misperception, and I think that needs to be very clear, there is a misperception that because these creatures are so similar to us, that they are valuable as research tools, and that research on these creatures is of value to humankind. And the research, however, points out that there has been really no benefit to humans from the use of chimpanzees in research. And that, to me, I think is very compelling. There's a great website on this. The New England Anti-Vivisection Society has done an extensive research program about the use of chimpanzees in research and whether or not it has been beneficial. And it's amazing to me how little people know about the fact that there really is no benefit of using these creatures in research for human beings. And I think that's one of the problems, is that we have that selfishness. But even if you want to be selfish, let's just look at it practically. Let's just look at it logically. And I encourage people to look at that research. It's neavs.org is the website. And it's under the research and restitution link. But they've just got some great information on that, in that topic. And the other issue is just simply, like you pointed out, if we wouldn't do this to a horse, we wouldn't do this to another animal. Think about it in this perspective: how is a chimpanzee different than a mentally incapacitated human, or than a 2 or 3 year old deaf-mute child who can't talk but can use sign language? And would we do these things to that individual?
Right. We would not use them as experimental beings.
Absolutely.
We just wouldn't, and we wouldn't subject. We couldn't sell them. Okay.
Exactly. We couldn't sell them. We couldn't take them out of their homes after they had been living there for 26 years, even though they can't talk and they can only use sign language, and put them in a research facility to live out the rest of their life in torture. We wouldn't do that to them to begin with. Let alone in Heasel's situation, where he's had a relatively comfortable life, because he was illegally taken from Africa and, is now facing the doom of a research facility.
Well, talk a little bit about Heasel, by the way, because he actually is becoming a person of the world.
Well, Heasel is a chimpanzee. He was taken in 1982. From West Africa with several other young chimps. They were being shipped to a research facility, and however, because of the laws that were in place at the time, they didn't have the proper documentation, and so he was sent to a sanctuary instead of, intercepted, and he was sent to a sanctuary. Where he has been, there is a woman in Austria, Paula Stibbe, who has had regular contact with him since the late 90s. And she is the person who has been proposed as the guardian for Diesel. Because the sanctuary where he currently is low on funds and facing bankruptcy, the only result may end up being that Hazel is sent to a research facility, or that he has to be sold outside of Austria where there really won't be any, unless he has a guardian, there will be no control over how he is used and where he's sent, because his property, he can be sold, he can be bought by the highest bidder. Hazel is not unlike any other chimpanzee that that is out there with respect to his mental capacity, his emotional well-being. Paula Sibby, for example, talks about how anytime she comes in, he greets her with kisses and hugs. And me personally, having worked with chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, I'll tell you that that's exactly how they are. They're very friendly. They recognize you. They become a friend in a large sense. They teach you games that they want to play. They will laugh with you. They'll cry. They want to learn. They're much like dealing with a small child, and that's how Hazel is. And he's just a big child in a big chimpanzee body, but he still needs the same protections that are currently reserved only for human persons.
People have pointed out that he's a very entertaining and lovable being, that he has his likes and his dislikes, he knows what he wants. He recognizes people. There's certain foods that he prefers, like certain pastries and things. And, you know, when we get to know these creatures, and a part of the difficulty is the fact that we are so isolated from them, the vast majority of people never really appreciate just how intelligent the animals are. You've had experience working with them?
I have, and that's something that I have always thought, if only every person could have an opportunity to spend even, you know, 2 or 3 days with one of these creatures, they would have their mind changed. I think they would clearly see them as individuals, not as just, you know, another piece of property or another being. They all have their own unique personalities. I was in Africa working with some a couple of years ago, and each one you have, you know, the one who likes to be the entertainer. He's a big goofball. He's the leader of the pack, but yet he's the one who is always making faces and trying to get people to laugh, or, you know, breaking up a fight and then starting a tickle fight instead. And they do each have their own individual personalities. I'm on the board of a gorilla sanctuary up here in North Georgia, and they have two gorillas. One who's 43 years old, and he's very mild, he's very gentle, he's very deliberate about everything he does. He absolutely adores my husband, thinks I'm okay, but my husband, he just, when my husband walks in, he starts, once he hears his voice, he starts purring and grumbling, because he's glad that he's there, and he'll display for him and he'll do play for him. And then, you know, there's another gorilla in the same sanctuary who is deaf, and that's why he's there, because he doesn't do well in zoos on display, because he gets scared easily. But he's got a totally different personality, has different things that he likes, different things that he dislikes. Some of them like to go outside and be outside all day long. Others like to hang out in the shade or hang out inside most of the day. They have different things that they like to play with. There's one of the gorillas in Africa that I used to enjoy working with. He loved getting leaves and dressing up and putting them on top of his head and running around with a hat on. Just a lot like children. They're just such amazing creatures, and they learn from you. And like I said, they laugh, they cry. One of my first experiences as a teenager was with a gorilla who was mentally disabled. And I worked with her for for months and months, and she used to just rock in a corner all day long. And after working with her for several months, she got up out of the corner and she came over and she looked in my eyes, and then she started playing patty cake with me. Hmm. And you know, from that point forward, we started developing a relationship, and she started teaching me games. And the day that I told her that I was moving, she started crying. And I was thinking, how do you know what I'm telling you? Maybe you can sense it in my voice. I don't know. But it was just an amazing experience to see that there is that level of emotion that they experience.
You're very fortunate. I wish that I had the opportunity to have that type of communion with these creatures so that I could even better understand it. And you're very fortunate. I'm going to push it just a little bit, and then we're going to come back to the mainstream topic here. But let's be honest here. I mean, you be honest with me. Tell me what you really feel is that connection. I mean, to what degree are you able to get a sense that there is a communion, a connection, a sharing of consciousness between you and those creatures? And, of course, it's a very personal thing.
It is. I can't explain it. It is a connection that when I go somewhere and I spent some time with a particular individual and have been gone for 4 years and come back, and it's clear that they recognize me. Because they're like any other creature. They're going to be hesitant. They're not going to come up to you immediately if they don't remember you, if they don't know who you are. And it takes a long time to develop that trust and to engage that trust. And then when you go back and they run up and hug you and they say, oh my gosh, you know, you've been gone so long, where have you been? And then they want to just sit and, you know, pet your face or look at you and look at your hand and smell you. You know, there's a clear recognition, a clear remembering of you as an individual. And just the different personalities. Some of them I don't have that much of a connection with. Others, there's an incredibly strong connection. It's funny because I'd say with animals, with all of the dogs I've ever had, with all of the pets that I've ever had, I've always developed a really strong connection with them. With great apes, they're much more individualized. Some of them, like I said, some of them, my husband has a much stronger connection than I do with some. Individually, you know, other people that I know have stronger connections with some versus others. It's so hard to explain. But, you know, when you're working with a chimpanzee, and chimpanzees are kind of notoriously selfish, and they're all running around trying to fight over a mango, and then you've got one that's your friend, and they come over and they pull you to a corner and they give you half their mango. You know, I'm just kind of going, hey, thanks, it's okay, you can have it. You know, no, I want you to. And there's this odd kind of connection. That's me personally. And whether I've got a connection or somebody else doesn't, it's really not what all this is about. Certainly that is what drives my passion. But I look at it from a very scientific, practical perspective when it comes to the Great Ape Project and the goals of the project.
One of the things that you shared that I find to be a common discussion, and that is that these animals seem to retain a memory of an individual person for years and years and years. I'm not sure that dogs do that to the same extent. It seems to me when I've run across a dog that perhaps I knew 4 or 5 years ago, it takes quite a while for them to really recognize me again, but it seems as if, again, I'm just speculating here, but as if the great apes have an even greater consciousness and connection with individuals than dogs, for example, which are so amazing in terms of communicating.
Right.
Well, we'll get back to the topic here. So let's talk about how it is that you're hoping to address this from a legal perspective. That's a tough one. What are your efforts here?
Our efforts are to really take a very practical approach and to legally gain the protections that are necessary to afford these creatures just the basic fundamental rights, the basic fundamental protection that they deserve. And that is, it's very simple, the right to life, to be free from being killed arbitrarily. You know, if I'm in a research facility and they've got too many chimpanzees and they can't feed them all, then, you know, just kill a couple off. That shouldn't happen. So there's that fundamental right to life, the freedom from arbitrary deprivation of liberty, from being deprived, from being able to roam in the wild, if that's where they happen to be, or from being confined in a small cage where you can barely move around. The protection from torture, from being stabbed with needles day in and day out, from being knocked down, from being injected with AIDS, which isn't going to affect the chimpanzee because they don't get sick from it, but is going to require that they now live their life in solitary confinement. Or the other more invasive procedures that go on with the great apes. So these are very basic fundamental protections, and unfortunately, as property, they don't get those protections. Certainly there are some animal cruelty laws, and there has been some movement in this direction. The Chimp Act made some good strides in this direction, but there are some flaws with it, you know, as far as the age where chimpanzees will be removed and retired into sanctuaries, and the loopholes in the Chimp Act that would allow a chimpanzee who has been taken to a sanctuary from a research facility to then be put back into research. So we've made some movement, but really the only true, the only surefire way to ensure these protections is through legal rights, and those rights being the personhood issue. And I'm not saying, you know, declare them as humans. I'm saying declare them legally as, or we're saying declare them legally as persons. Corporation is a legal person.
I'm just curious, you know, our law is based on precedent. So and if you're making a legal case, you almost have to rely on some sort of precedent. What legal basis are you using to make your case?
Well, there are a number of different legal precedents. I think the interesting one that's going on right now with Heisel is, and one of the things that is interesting is that a lot of people are misquoting the judge's ruling with respect to Heisel. She did express concern about, you know, granting the same legal status as humans, and the impression that that might give. But that wasn't the basis of her ruling. The basis of her ruling was that the argument was that Heisel was, you know, in the same capacity as, you know, somebody who couldn't protect themselves. And her ruling was based on the fact that he was neither mentally impaired nor in a state of emergency, not anything else. So she did not come out and say that he should not be granted personhood.
Right, but that the precedent didn't exist for that, those protections for either a person in imminent crisis or disabled, I think, is kind of the precedent.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That the precedent that was being relied on, or the precedent that she had available to her, would have said, okay, this, a guardian can be appointed to an individual in Heisel circumstances if that individual is deemed or declared by the court to be mentally impaired or in an emergency.
Now, I believe this is a foreign court, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Right. And how about in the United States? Are we making moves here as well?
There are moves in the United States. There have been a number of actions filed. There's been a recent case that resulted in a settlement out of court. So we haven't had any... we haven't had any direct legal precedent set. There have been a number of close calls, if you will. There was a situation of a chimpanzee, I believe, out in California, who unfortunately died shortly before the court's ruling, so it rendered the case moot. But there have been a number of suits that have been filed with respect to great apes that are used in entertainment. There have been actions filed. One of a big success was an action filed and resulted in the closing of the Coolston Foundation, which is the research facility, and the moving of the chimpanzees in that facility to sanctuary situations. And that's a lot of what Project R&R through NEEVS is working on, is the research chimpanzees in the United States.
Well, Michelle, I wish we could talk, and maybe we will have a chance again in the future, because I'd love to carry on this conversation and really continue to go in depth, but we do have limited time. So my question would be, so what is the status now of this in the Austrian courts, and the prospect that perhaps this may gain some traction around the world and even the United States, and then ultimately, what would this mean?
Well, where we are right now in the Austrian courts is that Hazel has been denied the guardianship that has been sought. That is going to be appealed, according to our sources, and we'll hopefully have a chance to have that reversed and to get the guardianship appointed to Hazel. And so that's where we are as far as the Austrian courts are concerned. It's a great opportunity to really bring this issue to the forefront, to really have people start thinking about it. And I think the important aspect is to really be educated about the efforts that are being made, educated on the law and what the law means, rather than just a first impression, wait a second, legal rights for great apes? That sounds crazy. I don't want apes to be able to vote and drive cars.
Which is unfortunately the total focus of the media right now.
And it is, and I understand that. I understand that from a layperson's perspective. It sounds radical. It sounds eccentric. It sounds crazy. And I come from a very conservative background, and so I tend to look at things very conservatively. And it's just interesting to me. So I understand the concern, the fear, and that's why, to me, it's so important for people to really look at it and see it for what it is, not for this radical, crazy idea to have, you know, chimpanzees driving cars. There is a growing support as people become more educated. We've seen it just this past spring, earlier, a couple months ago, the Balearic Parliament in Spain declared a resolution indicating their support for the granting of legal rights to great apes based on their intelligence and emotional parallels to those of humans. New Zealand, back in 1999, passed similar laws. UK government has banned experiments on great apes back in 1997. So around the world, we really are seeing a growing interest and a growing recognition that the current protections, if you want to call them that, the current legal treatment of these creatures is not sufficient, and something needs to be done differently. And, you know, under our current legal status, under our current legal structure, this is the way to accomplish those protections. And again, if people would actually look at it from what it really means in legal terms, I think they'd realize that it is not as radical as they think it is. And I think you'd find a lot more people supporting the idea and recognizing that no matter what religion you are, no matter what political side you tend to lean towards, it's just kind of a common moral issue that probably most people would agree on.
In terms of, let's say 5 years from now, this has made some progress and the legal precedents have been set. Then let's talk about the practical, simple side. What would that actually mean?
That would mean that we don't have great apes being used in research and being tortured. And that's the biggest aspect of it. We have some more teeth behind the laws in the countries where great apes, are roam free. We would probably not see a whole lot of movement with respect to the great apes that are currently housed in zoos with respect to their location, because practically speaking, there's just not enough sanctuaries out there. But I think you would see more of a movement to a sanctuary-like atmosphere for the great apes in zoos, a bigger focus on enrichment. And there are some zoos that do do take that into consideration. A lot of zoos who are moving towards that already, but looking at the enrichment and the efforts to really provide the best environment possible for these creatures, if they can't be sent to a sanctuary or to some other place so that they can be protected. You'd see the end of using chimpanzees and orangutans in entertainment and being tortured for our entertainment. You know, I think you'd see a world that is recognizing that we do have some moral and ethical obligations to not only ourselves, but also to these other creatures.
I can only believe that we benefit and prosper in that growth of our own consciousness and awareness, and that instead of the world being lessened by such laws and regulations, it would be dramatically and wildly enriched. We're talking with Michelle Stumpy, who is the president of the Great Ape Project USA and International. Michelle, if people want to find out more about what you're doing, what's the best way for them to learn more?
The best way would be to go to our website, which is www.greatapeproject.org.
Well, thank you so much. We'll continue this conversation in the future. It's one I definitely want to follow.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be following the story of Heasel in the weeks and months ahead. Tune in next week and every week as we bring you the most comprehensive coverage of the natural world and the most important 15 minutes on Earth with the weekly Earth Summit. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth reaches out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.